When news broke that Beats Music would be developing a music service, I got so excited. Finally, a company would make a product that regular people might care about. The reality is that most music services are for music fanatics, people who care about music. But most people don't care about music. They do not make the time to discover music or put together playlists. They want popular music, curated by experts, while they wash the dishes and feed the cat. That is the promise of Beats Music, and that is the focus of today's show. Welcome to The Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Here is my co-host, Courtney Harding, kicking off the interview with two brilliant digital music veterans. John Maples is the former VP of Product Management at Rhapsody International. Jonathan Sassy is the former SVP of Product Marketing and Content Programming at Slacker Radio.
So let's start chatting about Beats. It's been out for a week. Initially, it had some issues, product issues, operational issues. There were bugs in the onboarding process and troubles with scaling to meet demand, which could actually be seen as a positive thing. Now that both of you have spent some time with it, do you think it has potential to crack the mainstream market?
I think it's a very much an open question if it could actually break through the mainstream. I think there are some compelling pieces to it and some very interesting concepts around it in terms of the product. I would like to see more of the marketing plan and how the marketing was going to roll out. And really what it comes down to is how is this going to be distributed? Are they going to get the bundles that they need outside of the $15 family plan through AT&T to really power a lot of the growth here?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things with Beats, I think that's probably the most interesting from my perspective is just the amount of horsepower and star power that they have as far as delivering the service. It's not something that the, you know, streaming music industry has really seen yet. It's, you know, this is an industry that's been based a lot on price and features over the last decade, as well as maybe, you know, being ubiquitous and being able to get it in multiple places. But the launching pad that they've built their release around is pretty exceptional. And I think it's something that's really unlike anything that the industry has seen so far. And so I think that, you know, it doesn't surprise me that they had some growing pains out of the chute. That's kind of to be expected if you're, you know, seeing some trajectory that's maybe better than maybe what even they had expected, or that they hadn't even been able to test of what that might be like. But I think it's interesting. I think that they're running with a formula that really nobody else has done yet, and it'll be interesting to see how this goes.
So that said, I mean, and Beats has had a pretty big first week, although we haven't seen exact numbers from them. But even when you add up Beats, Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, Move, I mean, all of them together, the paid user base for all of it is still pretty small when you look at it in terms of comparing it to other ways people consume music. So, you know, lately we have seen a renewed interest among many companies in making the subscription model work, but in reality, only a handful of these services have really sort of, you know, reached fairly significant numbers of people, and certainly none of them have reached that really super mainstream middle America market. So why is that?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. I think the main thing has been that for years the problem was distribution. It was difficult to get the service. You had to have specific devices. You had to have a specific platform. Things weren't compatible with other things. As much as we'd have all liked to have been, it wasn't really set up to be a mainstream consumer experience. I think that there's, you know, been a lot of talk about whether people are willing to pay for content. And I actually think that there's plenty of cases in the market today, whether it's, you know, XM Sirius or whether it's Netflix, where people will pay for access to content. And as long as it's available in the places where they want to consume it. And so I think that there's plenty of size in the marketplace. I think there's plenty of demand from a consumer perspective. I certainly think that people are willing to pay for content as long as it's meeting their needs. I don't think that this is an industry that's necessarily completely anchored into a it's free or it's nothing kind of a model from a consumer standpoint. But the challenge has been with every service that you mentioned is that, you know, nobody has really been able on that's purely focused on the digital music. They haven't really been able to crack through from a super mainstream perspective, with the exception of potentially Pandora, of being able to have such a tremendous amount of people that have access to their service in all of the places that they want it. But from an on-demand music perspective, it's a game of thin margins. It's a game of lofty licensing requirements, and it's something that, you know, it's always been played in a lot of ways by the smaller players. And, you know, if you've got the horsepower to go big, it's a market that's ripe for opportunity for sure.
So one of the arguments that I have heard about streaming music, and I don't hear it as much anymore, but in the beginning, the argument was that people wouldn't be comfortable with music that they didn't own, that there was some sort of fundamental need for them to own the physical product or at least own the digital product when it came to music. But now we're seeing things like Netflix and Hulu, which are incredibly mainstream. You go to any house anywhere in the country, and you're probably pretty likely to meet people that have Netflix subscriptions, Hulu subscriptions, Amazon Prime streaming subscriptions. Like, those, you know, movies and TV have really cracked the mainstream in terms of streaming, but, like, music just hasn't.
I think it's very interesting in that respect that you have those two different models where, TV and video has killed it and music hasn't. And I think a big part of the problem with music is the expectations of all these companies and what they're actually offering customers. I would say, as somebody who has been involved in this for some time, we screwed it up. And I think we screwed it up because we didn't really think about what a customer is really looking to do. It seems like if you go look at all the marketing materials from all the companies that are out there, they all talk about 20 million songs for $10 a month. And I think it's pretty clear based on the numbers and the number of people who have come through all these services and rejected it that nobody really wants that. They're not looking for a huge catalog of music attached to a search button. And I think that is the fundamental flaw with like how this service has gone through so far. And what I think is really compelling about Beats is they take a completely different approach. They're like, it's not 20 million tracks. We're not even going to show you 20 million tracks. It's the right 20 songs for the moment. And I think that's really, through their content programming, what they're really trying to turn on a dime here is the idea of you're not buying a service with a search button. You're buying a service that is going to deliver you an experience. And I think that's really the key difference between the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't disagree with you, John, and anything that you said. I think the one thing that is, at least as I look at it right now, the one thing that fascinates me about what Beats is doing is that, you know, even though potentially their messaging is slightly different, they have a degree of polish that's definitely unique. And I wouldn't be surprised if we wouldn't be talking about a similar type of phenomenon for them, even if they were just doing a Spotify retread or a Songs or retread or a you name it service, that they, you know, put a pretty package around and some celebrity, firepower around it, that the buzz that they can generate given kind of who they've assembled and kind of what they've taken off to do is pretty exceptional. And I think that, time will tell if the service is going to be as exciting as kind of as they're making it out to be. But frankly, I think that if you look at what any other music service has done until now, for the most part, with a few exceptions, that the Beats marketing machine wrapped around any of those may have a similar result.
And Jonathan, I agree with that as well. I do think this really is about marketing and distribution just as much as it is about product. Because even we don't know if the product that Beats is putting together of that curated experience is something that customers are going to want to pay for anyways. It's still the jury's still out. And, you know, I think it really kind of comes down to that. Is that this something that people will pay for long term? But the marketing piece of this is really key in getting that first burst out.
One thing I think that might be the most amazing thing about this is that they've done with the MOG service and ultimately with the digital streaming service that they're rolling out, they've done with it almost exactly with what they had done with the headphone market, which I think was the big question of whether or not they'd be able to do that, which is, could you take something that, you know, there was a big question mark about whether anybody would pay $400 for a pair of headphones, and especially at Best Buy for that matter, or Walmart. And, you know, could you take that and doing nothing but making it sexy, putting it on, you know, celebrities, phenomenal product placement, and going out there and basically saying that, you know, if you're going to be part of this movement, you need to be with Beats. And you're going to pay for it, and you're going to be part of a subculture, and you're going to be part of, you know, mainstream pop culture with this, and you're going to need to have this, and you're going to pay the $400 for it or the $200 for it, when you as a customer may have only ever spent 20 or 30 bucks on a pair of headphones in your whole life. And there was a lot of doubt that that would be something that could possibly be successful, certainly at big box retail. And they pulled it off with a very similar strategy. And I think it's brilliant. I think they're doing exactly the right thing.
I think it totally fits within the way they approach their products, for sure. And that, you know, it comes down to the as Jonathan mentions, the amount of marketing muscle and the level of celebrity that they can throw at the market to connect the two. And I think these two products, the headphones and the service, really work in tandem. And I think a big question is, can they support each other? Because of selling headphones, can that sell more copies of, like, more subscriptions to Beats Music? And if you use Beats Music, are you going to be more adept to, like, buy the headphones too? And I think that's the big bet here, is that they can combine the two and get a lot of great growth between the two of them.
Another analogy to that, to your point, might be that for, you know, the years before these headphones ever showed up, when you were shopping for headphones, they were talking about, here's the low-end frequency, here's the high-end frequency, here's this and this response, here's how much bass it's got. It was all the tech specs they could think of to throw at you that you might make a buying decision with. And in a lot of ways, Beats kind of threw that out the window and said, look, you can come into the store and listen to them, and they're going to sound awesome. And we're going to put a name on these headphones that you're familiar with, from a DJ and somebody who you believe to know music perhaps even better than you do. And just trust us, because $400 is worth it. And when you put these on at the store, you're going to be blown away. And you don't need to know the specs, and you don't need to know all the details. Just trust us, because we know what we're doing. And I feel like that's kind of what they're going with the music service, too, is they're saying, you know, look, if you're going to see, you know, Jimmy, or you're going to see Dre, or you're going to see Trent out there talking about what's great about music and why you need to be with Beats Music, as a music fan, even if you're not necessarily the music tastemaker, you're not the pitchfork guy, but you like music and you like to listen to music all over the place, and you see these icons out there saying, this is what it's all about, this is, you know, artists, you know, helping to deliver great music to fans. And it's a great message with a very credible spokespeople, and it's a tried and true measure for just about anything. If you have Michael Jordan telling you need to buy basketball shoes, you're on board, even if they're not the best basketball shoes in the market. And when you have Dre saying, "Hey, when it comes to, you know, well curated music, trust me, this is great," it's an endorsement that few services have ever had the luxury of having.
I think that's incredibly well said, Jonathan. For now, we're going to table this discussion about marketing, which we'll come back to a little bit later in the show. Now we're going to talk about this larger concept of the streaming music wars. The mainstream media likes to portray the competition among the music streaming services as a war. Everybody against everybody. Each music service is competing for the listener. I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on whether that media narrative is accurate.
I think the answer to that is no. I think if Beats is only going after the customers that have signed up for Spotify and RDO and Rhapsody, and even if you even go further into like Pandora, I think that it would be a massive failure for them just because there are so few people that are actually subscribed to those services and actually will pay for them. Their whole point is to go to middle America, to go to a mass audience and sign up as many of those people as you possibly can. I also believe that like each of these companies are kind of taking a little bit of a different approach to how they're going after it. To me, Spotify is mostly about like if you want to share your music with your friends, if you want to see what your friends are listening to, go to Spotify. If you find a track for free on the web and you want to play it, Spotify is going to be there because they have an API. But I don't necessarily think that it fits exactly with where Beats is going, but basically because it's like not a free product and they're not competing in them. So it seems like you have different approaches to, at least for the two big players who are going across it in different ways.
Yeah, I might have a slightly different perspective on that in the sense that I think there is a battle around the dollar. I mean, there's this kind of this, I think, general consensus from an industry perspective that the rising tide is going to help everybody. That, you know, as long as streaming music in general is perceived as the solution for consuming music, then everybody's got a shot at some kind of a victory. And that it's not necessarily a battle amongst companies for that, that there's some kind of a common goal in a sense to make sure that this is the way that everybody's moving to get access to their content. And I think that's in some ways undeniable. However, if it comes to, you know, getting money from a consumer, not just, you know, their ears and their, you know, advertising opportunities, but if you want to get $3, $4, $5, $10, $15 from somebody every month, in order to have access to content, then there definitely is a very aggressive competition that's out there, in the sense that not, I would say, not necessarily, you know, to John's point, that, you know, someone might come out and say, I want to go take, you know, the money that Spotify's got and try and turn put it in my own pocket. But I think that there's this, you know, the more ubiquitous it becomes, and the more that companies want to try and get you to give them money every month to use their service, there's no question that consumers aren't going to do that with multiple services. They're going to select the service that they want to use the most, and that's who's going to get their money every month. And yeah, maybe they dabble on the side with other services because they have a particular feature or some nuance that gives them something that they didn't get with their other service. But something's going to make them decide to pay and want to continue to pay every month. And there's absolutely a battle that's brewing there that is, in a lot of ways, is really vicious, because every service out there knows that one customer is not going to pay for multiple services, and they've got to get their opportunity to get them subscribed as soon as possible and hold on to them because the other guy might take them down the road.
There's another war going on between the platform companies, right? Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, they're all fighting for the consumer. They're jumping in the ring with these, you know, smaller upstarts like Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, and Slacker. What are the challenges of being a smaller upstart going against these platform giants?
Just like anything, I would say that, you know, when you have startups, you know, swimming in the same pond with industry giants that have similar goals, that there's something brewing. And I think that if you look far enough down the road, which is kind of, I think, usually the case when it comes to this, is that, you know, all of these, you know, music services are going to have some decisions to make. And I think that when you look at what most are depending on, when you get right down to it, is ad revenue. Ad revenue and ad margins are thin. They're hard to come by, and it takes, in most cases, either an exceptional platform and or a giant, you know, a giant sales force in order to be able to monetize that at the scale that's needed. And when you look at the players in the space and who has, you know, what to lose, it starts looking very interesting when you see people like Facebook and Google, you know, again, swimming in that same pond. And these are the guys that can monetize advertising like nobody's business. And if they have a strong desire to play in this space, they're going to be the ones that can ultimately monetize these free listeners. And when this gets to, you know, not hundreds of thousands, not a few million people listening, you know, not even, you know, tens of millions of people, that even in some cases the scope of what Pandora is seeing. But when this becomes a service that everyone uses, when you use it in your car every day, when you use it at home, when you use it on your cell phone, when you're constantly consuming content with this and you're willing to pay for it, or you want to make sure that you always get it for free, the big dogs are going to be the ones that are monetizing this, and they're going to be driving that platform. I think it's inevitable that there's some consolidation there. And in some cases, you know, the likely players are going to be the ones steering the ship at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan, I think that's an astute point, especially about the ad revenue piece of it. But there's also a challenge with the ad revenue piece, too, in that, you know, it's very difficult to build a successful, you know, ad company. Google has been able to do it because of AdWords, but it doesn't really exactly translate for this next level if you're talking about music in particular. So, I think it's still an open question who wins that ad revenue world, you know, war in the next level. I see these big companies coming in, and what I see each of them doing are trying to sell something else or trying to acquire a customer in a different way, and using music and games and video and apps as ways to actually put together, you know, a casual time of a customer, and they want to win all of them. You know, I don't think Google wants to win just music. I think they have to have a music offering, but they also have to have a books offering and, you know, a video service and all their apps too. So to me, I think when these big multiple, you know, companies that have all kinds of services and they're trying to get you to be on their app store and buy from them all the time, those companies, I think, are going to have a less of a focus than the direct companies. But, you know, Jonathan, I think you're totally right that we are going to see consolidation. We are going to see people drop out of this space just because there's not going to be money to support, like, everything that's out there. And I think at a certain point in time, even these big companies are going to have to decide, especially when it comes to music, something that is incredibly expensive. Do we, you know, have our own offering? Do we do the Google, you know, Play Store? Or do we just do a co-marketing deal with Beats and put it into the Play Store?
That gets right towards one of the last questions I wanted to ask in this part is, what does success for Beats Music look like? We talked about this idea of leveraging the music service as positioning to sell more headphones. That's, you know, a smaller play, and as Maples was saying, about what other large platform companies are doing to get people into their store and sell them other things. Meanwhile, you have companies like Pandora, who did the IPO. Their founding team, their investors made money that way. It looks like Spotify wants to jump in that arena as well. They're getting far too big to acquire, arguably, and they're looking to do the IPO to raise that extra money. What does success look like for Beats Music?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that, and this goes for all music services, frankly, is that you have to find a way that you can scale incredibly large without imploding in the process or burning out the amount of cash that you've got. The one thing that Spotify has been able to do is leverage deep pockets, you know, burning cash at a phenomenal rate in some cases in order to move to the kind of scale that, you know, to your comment, Kyle, puts them, you know, potentially too big to acquire. I think that when it comes right down to it, you know, the driving force is going to be, you know, companies that have a global footprint, that have billing capabilities, and have the ability to monetize a lot of traffic. And I think that's really what's going to dictate success. And I don't think that any individual music service company on their own is likely to accomplish that. I think that there's, you know, for Beats and potentially even for Spotify, I mean, there's no question that, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and the Microsofts of the world, that Apple as well in some cases, have no problem throwing down billions of dollars if it's the right move for them at the right time. And I think it's hard for any music service to get more valuable than that. And so I think really what they've got to do is you know, they're, you know, obviously out of the gates in the right way, but, you know, get big fast and do it in such a way that, you know, you're not in peril of flaming out before you can possibly get to the scale you need to get to. And I think anymore, I think for the most part, I think the exit for most of these companies, like most startups, is going to be acquired by a giant that's willing to pay for the footprint that they get and potentially the brand value they get and the audience that they get, so that they don't have to grow it themselves, because frankly, most of the giants really struggle with that.
I think that's a good point all across the board too. Getting big and getting big quickly. I think, you know, the key for Beats, I think it's going to be pretty obvious pretty quickly. And I think they have to win the US. I think it has to be a home run immediately. Just because, you know, as Jonathan mentions, it's incredibly expensive to like become an international company overnight. And the big players, they're already doing it. I mean, you know, they have staffs around the world. They have, you know, stores in almost every major country. And they're executing that plan where Spotify is what, like about, you know, 2/3 of the way through, and Beats is in one country. So allowing them to actually spread, you know, the Beats love everywhere and get it around the world very quickly is going to be really key. But I think they have to win the U.S. to, you know, keep the skeptics at bay.
I want to get back to talking about the marketing stuff a little bit. You know, Jimmy Iovine has been marketing this like he would a major album release, like we said earlier. And Ian Rogers is this rock star CEO, and he's got Trent and Dr. Dre, and they're like walking into the football games, and they're, you know, they're really blowing this marketing out. But I wonder how much it's going to work. And I also wonder why no one has really looked at the other part of this, which is like these services can compete on price against how people are already consuming music, which is like, I was at a record store for an in-store a few weeks ago, and I looked at a CD, and the CD, like one individual CD, was $12.99. And I just stood there. I was like, oh, this is such a ripoff. I mean, I pay for Spotify and I pay less than this. So why haven't they really marketed it all? I'm like, look, you know, this is really cheap. Like, this is the cheapest way you'll consume music. Why hasn't that been a big marketing point, do you think?
Courtney, I think that's a good point about the heavy consumer. But I would also say that most people are not the heavy consumer. What the average, you know, music customer buys something in the range of $50 of music a year. So to subscribe to Spotify or RDO or Beats for a year is going to cost you $120. So you're talking about more than twice the amount that the average customer, that's the average customer, spends on music in a year. So I think it's a tall order to get there. I kind of share a little bit of the skepticism too around this, with the marketing piece of it. The first ad that I saw felt just like pretty much what everybody else said, except it promised magic on top of it. And I see how Beats Music or Beats by Dre markets, and it's completely different. You know, the minute after the playoff game 2 weeks ago ends up, the Richard Sherman commercials on TV, like perfect timing. And it's like perfect for like what they wanted to sell. It was awesome. And I think they need to bring that kind of like star power and that kind of cultural relevance into the marketing to really make it zing.
I think that, you know, to the second point, as far as price goes, you know, that I think John's point is right as far as what the mainstream consumer is doing. And if you think about it, what the mainstream consumer is doing is they're listening to music for free. And free is hard to compete with. And it's one of the few industries where the price has fallen all the way to zero for general consumption of content. We haven't seen that happen in other places. It's certainly not at a mainstream level. I mean, there's always been ways to pirate content. But a mainstream consumer who spends hours and hours and hours on YouTube every week or day can easily look at a song and listen to a song and play a song. And it's a trivial thing to go to the web and play a song whenever you want to. And so, you know, you have a different value proposition to now try and convince that same person to say, you should give me money now to do basically what you're doing, but it's going to be slicker, or it's going to be better, or you're going to have more access, or you're going to have better playlists, or whatever it might be. But the value proposition is definitely different to you're trying to get people who are typically now used to paying zero to pay something. And that's a tall order. And that's why everyone has the free component of their service at this point, because it's not good enough to just have a subscription service or just have a for pay service, whatever it might be. And then on the marketing side, I think being able to sustain what they're doing is going to be really important. Coming out in a big bang in January and then hoping to ride that for the foreseeable future obviously won't work. Not to say that that's what their plan is, but that can't be their plan. I think one thing we saw with the Beats headphone marketing was they had a pretty slow burn. Now, some of it was because they had to, given the type of market they were in, but there was this growing presence of Beats where they spent a lot of time and money to make sure that the people who you looked up to, you saw wearing Beats headphones. That eventually that happened. You would see someone wearing Beats headphones, whether it was a friend that was an influencer that had gotten into buying a set of headphones, or it was some kind of a celebrity that you happened to watch. I don't think any of us can think of a time where some celebrity hasn't been spotted wearing a Beats headphones of some sort. And that has a lot of staying power for them. And I think if they tackle the service in a similar way, where they just keep recruiting and they keep recruiting and they keep pushing so that the artists that I listen to are telling me that Beats is the way to go, they've got a very strong head of steam for them that they can really push through this year with and grow.
Yeah, so I kind of want to talk a little bit more about the for Beats Music ad as opposed to the Beats headphones ad. And the Beats headphones ad, the Richard Sherman one, there was a Colin Kaepernick one, they've done them with basketball stars that I've seen. Like, those are phenomenal ads. The music is great, the visual is great, like, they are just amazing ads. And the Beats Music ad, I didn't feel like I was really blown away by it. And I look at Spotify's advertising, and they had a big ad campaign, and RDO's advertising, and none of it to me has really seemed like it can reach that, again, mainstream consumer. Like, they have these really cool, slick, pretty ads, but they don't have like a basketball star in them, and they don't have any way that they're reaching the mainstream consumer. So do you think streaming services have fallen short on the product marketing efforts, and maybe that's one of the reasons they've, again, yet to really break out?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that most of the companies haven't really understood what the customer really wants. And because of that, they're having a hard time describing it. You know, I mean, like, Rhapsody had an ad that was incredibly similar to the Spotify ads that came out this past year, about 5 years ago. And it's almost the same thing. And the Beats ad kind of feels the same way. But I think this kind of goes back to Jonathan's point, too. It's like, marketing isn't something that, like, blows you away in the first minute. It's something that rolls and takes time to develop. And Jonathan probably can talk more about it than I can, because he's been much more involved in that than I am. I'm a critic of marketing, not as much of an expert of marketing.
You know, one thing about it, I think, is, and that I think is important, is that very few of the music services that have been competing today, including Spotify, I would say, in a lot of ways, very few of these companies can budget for the type of campaign that's needed to do what they're trying to do. And it's always been about, you know, can you hit a viral home run? Can you somehow crack the code on a feature set or an interface that's going to delight people enough to want to invite others to do it? You know, can you tap into social networking vortex in some way that's going to spin you up into oblivion? And those are all really, really hard things to do. However, when it comes to promoting a blockbuster movie or a massive tour or a big album release, I mean, these are things that they require a tremendous amount of resources. It's something that you can't go light on. You could have the best product in the world, but if you're just not able to get that message out there, it's not going to resonate. And I think that this is something that they're doing well so far. And even if their commercials and their marketing efforts that are out right now aren't necessarily blowing you away, the thing that they're doing exceptionally well is they're kind of touring as this kind of pseudo all-star team that's really getting the press kind of wound up. Is that if it was just Ian and it was just Ian out there saying, look, we've done this before, we're going to blow the doors off this thing, and it's, you know, Mog 2.0, I think you would have nothing against Ian. You'd have a collective yawn from everybody saying, oh, it's another music service, here we go again with all the features and the new stuff. But the combination of you know, the tech experience that Ian brings to the table that you have. I mean, obviously Jimmy's horsepower is extremely well renowned from an entertainment perspective, and then to have the artists as well. It's a great formula for drumming up media anticipation and excitement. And that's a story that I think that everybody gets excited to tell. I had Dr. Dre show up and talk to me about this service. That's something that, you know, you can't help as a journalist to get excited about when, you know, you can talk about Westergren and you can talk about Daniel Ek and, you know, maybe even early on with David Hyman and Log, is that there was a certain industry celebrity about a lot of those folks. But there wasn't this pop celebrity that Beats is really touting right now. And it's easy to get kind of frothy about it when those guys show up.
These guys, they show up and, you know, it's not like the technologists. It's the people that end up on TMZ. They're real celebrities. I mean, it's a completely different game.
Yeah, I mean, so just to kind of follow up on that, I mean, do you think this will eventually be a successful marketing campaign? And can you think of any? I mean, I know we've sort of picked a lot of it apart, but are there successful marketing campaigns that you've seen in streaming music?
No, I don't think so. Because you know what I would say on that is I wouldn't necessarily say that the campaigns that people have run were unsuccessful in the sense of that, you know, they might have been well crafted, they might have been well targeted, but they were always underfunded in almost every way. Somebody might have tried to go big and say, I'm going to run a huge campaign for the next 4 weeks, and then we're going to see if that somehow makes us great. Or I'm going to run a very clever, well-targeted campaign to a small subset of people for a long time and hope they get the word out because they're the influencers of the marketplace. And that's a tough game when you're trying to become a massive mainstream success. You know, you got to go big. And, you know, the fact that they have a lot of those weapons right now, it just gives them the extra oomph that others don't have. And frankly, even when you buy a spokesperson, if you go out and say, I'm going to go pay Alicia Keys to go out and try and promote the new BlackBerry because that seems like a really great idea, that's one thing. But the fact is that's not somebody who is, you know, contributing to the product themselves. And I think that's where the Beats headphones made a really strong play, because you had Dr. Dre out there hitting the street saying, I spent, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours trying to make sure that these were the headphones that I want to wear and make sure that if I'm going to put my name on it, they're going to be great. And if he's doing the same thing for the service and Trent's doing the same thing for the service, that you really can't quite buy that if you're another music service and you say, I'm going to go spend, you know, X millions of dollars and we're going to go pay somebody to go talk about how awesome our service is. It's not the same as if it's part of the DNA. And Beats is telling that story very well right now, which is that this is the collective DNA of the company and these are the rock stars that you trust.
Yeah, there have been a couple like opportunities for people to go out and try to market, and something's always been off. Rhapsody and Viacom had a pretty good co-marketing plan where they threw significant dollars at it, but unfortunately, it was before the smartphones hit, and so most people had to, you know, go buy a Sansa device or something to like take their music on the go, and you know it was just the wrong time to spend a couple hundred million dollars on the MTV networks. So it seems like this is the right time and this is the right product and, you know, this is the right team to go after it.
Yeah, you know, I guess I never thought of it from the mainstream press perspective because I come from the music press background. So for me, it's like I would almost rather talk to a CEO than talk to a Dr. Dre or Trent Reznor, not that I don't like both those guys. But if you are, you know, a mainstream reporter at a big daily paper or at a big sort of mainstream, you know, magazine that a lot of people read, that's much more exciting. Like, you don't really care that Daniel Ek has come into your office, but like, Dr. Dre, you loved that record back when you were in high school. Like, that's so exciting. So, yeah, that's interesting. That's something I hadn't thought about before, but that's a really cool point.
So next, I'd like to turn the conversation to talking about music curation. Jimmy Iovine famously said that no music service has succeeded at curation, and even sort of posited that no music service does curation. Of course, you know, Courtney and I know that's not the case. Rhapsody has a staff of experts who seek out music to include in blog posts, email blasts, and song playlists. Slacker has a staff of DJs who manage and program music across hundreds of web radio stations. How does the Beats music curation strategy differ from your past efforts?
Sure. It's a lot more of it, frankly. They're double or triple quadrupling down on actually bringing curation in, whereas Rhapsody had a very thin layer of curation that went across everything. So it just couldn't cover the amount and create that, like, you know, depth of experience of music that you absolutely have to have. And every single day you go in and something new is there that is perfect for your taste, designed for like what you've listened to before and what you want to listen to right now. So to me, it just seems like it takes, you know, the old models of like, let's sprinkle a little content programming on top of this huge database of music, and says, no, we're going to do it differently. We're going to really, really pour our resources into the content programming side of it to actually, you know, link it together.
Yeah, I would say, from my perspective, you know, what Jimmy's comments to me remind me a lot of Steve Jobs, is you latch on to something that you know is the right answer, that you know that other people are doing and maybe even are doing extremely well, but haven't had the muscle to convince other people that it exists, and then you go out and embrace it and claim it for yourself. And that is a trademark Steve Jobs Apple philosophy on how to win on something that's great that just hasn't been exposed to the mainstream yet. And it's something I think Jimmy's smart to do it without question. But when it comes to curation, you know, curation's been going on for a long time with a lot of services. I know firsthand the amount of effort that can go into some of these experiences from a curation standpoint. And in fact, perhaps even having, you know, a single genre expert spending nothing but their time making sure that the right song plays next, which I've heard Jimmy and others at Beats comment a lot, that it's not so much even about what's playing now as what plays next. And that, in a lot of ways, is kind of the heart of curation. You know, certainly we invested a tremendous amount of effort at Slacker to do that. And I think we did it very well. But, you know, from my perspective, they're latching onto the right thing. It's the right differentiator. It's if you have, you know, millions of songs is not the answer. Having a search box to find content is not the answer. Being able to assemble teams of people that know music better than anyone else to try and help listeners get the right music experience, that's the right answer. And he's embracing that smartly, and also smartly discrediting the competition of saying, you know, they haven't really even tried. I'm not convinced that they're, even today, are doing it at the level of what a lot of the other services are doing it at, but they're claiming it, which is smart, and they're putting all their messaging points around it, which is what they need to do.
Right, the marketing piece of it. You know, I think the other thing is that this is really difficult to do. I mean, Jonathan, you mentioned how much effort you put into it. Like, what they're promising, this level of magic that they're going to deliver for you, is very, very hard. And, you know, based on what I've seen so far, I've seen some signs of it, but it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort from now on, just as much as like the marketing, for them to really, really nail it. So, you know, what we've seen for the first part, interesting, you know, some pretty good stuff, but it's still out if they're able to really deliver that magic message.
One of the companies that has been very focused on music curation, especially expertly curated playlists, is Songza. Their music concierge feature debuted and dramatically impacted how music streaming executives think about playlist curation. Why did Songza and their execution of the music concierge service have such a huge impact on the way that we thought about how music is curated and why people want to listen to it?
Well, I think a lot of that comes to, there's kind of this blend. And one of the things that makes radio as a concept in a lot of ways better than other things is that you push a button and music continues to happen. You don't have to create something in order to have an experience. And one of the things that Songza did, I think, is embrace that philosophy along with genre busting. So there's been a lot of focus in the music industry decades and decades that music is assembled around genres. And I think that the thing that was clever from Songza's perspective is they broke that down into more of, you know, activities and moods and things that are related to what I might be doing right now. So it's that, what am I playing music for? Not necessarily what type of music am I looking to play. And I think that was a pivot point in for the entire industry in some senses, where that hadn't been tackled in some capacity before, but it was that combination of the dynamic playlist, that kind of radio push, play, and go concept, combined with, you know, I am going for a Sunday drive. I am, you know, going to work out. There's these events in my life that I want music to accompany. And they gave me those choices without me having to figure out, I'm going to the gym, do I want to listen to metal or hip hop? It became, I'm just going to the gym. And that was a very interesting step that they kind of forced others to reconsider.
Yeah, I think we as an industry just didn't recognize that people are actually just looking for music for events in their lives and for their daily routines. And they just nailed it. I mean, absolutely nailed it. And I think that's very interesting, Jonathan, about the genre busting. And if you like would, you know, take that idea of how they've busted it up and say activities instead of genre, and think about how Pandora has come in and doesn't really have much in the genre and just do it based on artist. Those two services have really, you know, either they're reflecting the fact that genres don't really matter anymore, which is my personal feeling, or they're actually driving the fact that genres don't matter anymore.
Yeah, I think it's also about, you know, to that same end, it just goes down to that kind of the most base input I can give you to go play what I want. And, you know, trying to narrow down what I want to do right now in a music genre, it may be way too limiting. And certainly, if I want to go make a playlist, that may be too involved. And I think that's where Pandora and Spotify have continued to do well. Because I say, I have a song stuck in my head or an artist stuck in my head. I'm going to tell you that. And then you go off and play me stuff that might match my taste right now. And that's what Pandora does well. And songs that may have a similar thing, which might say like, hey, I'm going to go out for a bike ride. I just want some great music to ride my bike to. And I don't even know what that is, but I'm riding my bike and that's what I want to do. And it's a very clever way to give somebody to provide you the most minimal amount of input to get started and deliver a good experience as a result.
Yeah, I also think that no one who's copying songs right now is doing it exceptionally well. They're all kind of missing it a little bit. And that includes Beats with their activities area. It's just, it doesn't have the polish or the feel that Songza has. And, you know, what I love about Songza is that you pick an activity and then you take a path down kind of a music style you like. And I think those two things combined together really, you know, provide a pretty awesome little service.
You know, it's interesting. I've had a chance to walk around New York with Elias Roman, who's the co-founder and CEO of that service. What he told me is that a large part of what went into developing the current feature set in Songza that we now know as Music Concierge is that everyone in the company spent time talking to mainstream music listeners, asking them questions about how they listen to and discover music. And after a long period of comparing notes and talking to people, what they realized is that people at the end of the day aren't necessarily looking for a music experience that's in the foreground of their lives. They're looking for a background activity to their activity that aligns with what they're doing, that catalyzes how they're feeling. And if they can push some buttons with very little effort, narrow the choice of options, and dive into a great experience, that is the experience that they believed consumer wanted based on what they told them. And then they went out and created that experience.
It's interesting, though, that Beats isn't taking that approach. That they're still coming at it from taste and from, and they start with genres. I mean, they ask you to name three genres that you like.
Yeah, you know what's funny about that, and this comes, you know, for, like I said, spending a lot of time with a lot of curators and in building these things, is that real music aficionados, the people that are either live and breathe music every single day, in a lot of ways, will refuse to believe that someone could possibly just want to listen to music about riding a bike. Right. It just, it's at their core, it doesn't make sense to them. And I would wager that if you sit down with Trent or Dre or Jimmy or anybody, you know, very, very closely connected at the artist level, with Beats, and you said, you know, hey, what does a playlist to go into the gym sound like? In a lot of ways, they'll give you the most confused look. They'll be like, I can't possibly answer that because I don't know if you work out to techno. I don't know what kind of reps you do. I don't know if you like new hip hop or old hip hop. And they'll give you all the reasons in the world why there's no way you could possibly make that playlist for somebody. And that's one thing where I think Songza was very clever in the sense they said, you know what? If people want a good set of music for a Sunday drive, we're going to give you that. And not necessarily think about what are all the music implications about why that's impossible.
I'd like to add to that thread a little bit about this idea of how much effort music consumers really want to put into their services. We've seen this really interesting shift in the last couple years that is quite profound if you think about it. Over 10 years ago, the iPod and iTunes encouraged an entire generation of music listeners to become the curators of their playlists, to take over control of the programming. And that thesis carries till present day with Spotify, who really focuses on create all of your playlists, share them with your friends, sync them to your mobile device. Everything, albums, must be saved as a playlist in order to play well in their ecosystem. And as we've been talking about, Beats Music is saying, no, that approach is wrong. Listeners don't want to put all that effort. They want those playlists curated by experts. So I'd like the sort of final weigh-in to be, do music listeners, the mainstream music listeners, really want playlist control?
Well, I think that, you know, there's some key points along the way, even if you go back to the iPod, that show kind of what consumer behavior was really like, which is that even though playlists became kind of a thing, you make a playlist and that becomes the thing that you use to represent. And in fact, in some cases, what Songza has done, you know, my trip to the gym or my workout or my, you know, studying music or whatever it might be. And what ultimately won, because of how stale that content would get, was shuffle. In fact, to the point where they built a whole product around doing nothing but shuffling content. And it became this kind of this thing, which is like, playlists have a tendency to get stale. Playlists require some amount of work. There's a benefit to having a playlist, which is that you know exactly what you're going to get. But the longevity of a playlist is kind of dubious. And in almost all aspects of music services, music devices, you know, any kind of point of consumption, if there's a playlist structure around it, then typically the way the consumer can, you know, accesses that is to go around it, is to either shuffle it or mix it up or put on a radio station or an interactive radio station or turn a song into a radio station or take 10 playlists and smash them together. The irony is that all the effort that went into creating this structure around making a playlist, ultimately, the way it was most often consumed was the way to smash all that up into something else. And so I think that the if you look at where most of the music that's being consumed is either something that's on some kind of a shuffle, some kind of interactive radio, or some kind of a broadcast radio, where ultimately you don't have control, it is the way that people tend to listen to music. You see people get more delighted when they don't know what the next song is, or when they have some amount of unpredictability in what they're listening to. And that's a much more enriching experience in some ways. And as a result, every single device and music service that's ever been released has given you a way to bail out of the structure that was put in place for that. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, building a service around that delight and that uncertainty that comes around with music, it is still going to be the best thing to do, but there's always going to be some level of control that people might want to grab occasionally and say, hey, for this particular moment, I want these 10 songs in a row, and that's what I want to do. But very few, in fact, almost nobody listens to just playlists in exactly the order that they were crafted.
Right. Jonathan, good point. And I think there's something that is missing in a lot of the services around the idea of mystery, which is like, you know, I don't know what the next song is going to play, but I love it when I hear it. So I definitely agree that that's a key part of it. And when I think about the music consumer, I think about, you know, the music consumer's life. And the music consumer's life is very, very different. And, you know, they have different ways and different things they're doing a day. And if you go back to, you know, the product building concepts around it, you're building products that solve a problem for a customer at a certain point in time. And, you know, I think sometimes with music services, we get kind of wrapped up into one model or the other and say, this is the way the customer is, or this is the way the customer is. But it changes throughout the day. I might want music for cooking dinner. I might want music for chilling out at the end of the night. I might want to listen to Damn the Torpedoes right now. You know, I might want, you know, a radio station that can power me through work. And those different things that that customer has through the day basically dictate like what they really are going to use at that point in time. Now, frankly, like with all these services, I think, you know, we've all started, at least for the to the time being, with either, you know, a radio station or choose your own adventure. Here's your, you know, search box. Go figure it out. And I think, you know, both of those have their advantages and disadvantages. But, you know, anyone who actually really thinks that they really want to, you know, control their experience 100% of the time, we've got everyone who actually wants to pay for that. They're already subscribed to one of the services. It's the rest of everything else that's out there that we need to, you know, the mainstream audience that we need to go out and figure out what exactly are they trying to solve at that point in time and make sure that we're giving them that experience for that point in time.
Guys, that was incredibly well said on the last answer to that question. Thank you so much for coming on the show. John Maples, if people want to find you online, how can they get a hold of you?
I have a website. It's johnmaples.com, no H. And I also have Twitter at jmaples.
Jonathan Sassy, where can people find you online?
Twitter is probably a good spot for me. It's at jsassy on Twitter.
Thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
That's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thank you to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email them to upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, and if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you for listening.